Good morning. So last time we were talking about Huffman coding, which was an application for both trees and heaps. And our goal was to do what we call lossless compression. We wanted to take some data and represent it with less space. And our basic procedure we were going to use for compression is we'd first choose some set of symbols to divide the document into, like characters. We'd be taking advantage of the fact that those symbols would not be evenly distributed, that we'd use some symbols more than others. And the idea would be that those more frequently used symbols we could represent more compactly. This is not, for example, what ASCII does. In ASCII, an exclamation point uses the same amount of space in a file as a space character, even though in a typical text file you have way more space characters than exclamation points. So what we do is we choose these variable length encodings for symbols. And we had this particular kind of code, which we called a prefix code, where no code we chose for a symbol was a prefix of another. And this meant that as we were going through a document that was encoded this way, we wouldn't have to worry about ambiguity. We always knew that if we knew where a symbol's code started, we always knew what symbol that was. There was no chance for it to be two things. Didn't need to worry about that. And this also meant we had this natural tree representation of a code, where we just have edges representing the bit we add to the code. Our codes we chose were just all sequences of single bits. And we just went down an edge of the tree. When we had a 0, we chose the left edge. When we had a 1, we chose the right edge, until we ended up at a node which didn't have any children. It was a leaf. And it told us what symbol that the code meant. And taking advantage of this representation, we built these codes using an algorithm we discussed that turns out to produce optimal codes in the sense that once we choose what the symbols are and we know their frequencies, it produces, of all prefix codes, the one that has the smallest amount of space for our document that's encoded this way. And the way this worked is we had this priority queue ordered by frequency of partial prefix code trees. So we construct little sub-prefix codes of, it turned out, the least popular symbols. And then we group them together, and eventually we get a prefix code for everything. And that overall prefix code would be what we use to encode the document. So we were building it from the bottom up. We're at the bottom of our prefix code tree, one of the least frequent things. That makes sense that they'd be at the bottom, because the least frequent symbols should have the longest codes. And the most frequent ones want to have the shortest codes. And when we're building from the bottom up, we decide on the shortest codes we give anything last. Yes?
Can you talk about like how there's no ambiguity in prefix, like the prefix is something, or like two things won't have the same prefix. When you're going down a tree, wouldn't every, like, if there's always going to be something that has, if like the first thing is a 0, isn't there something else that could have a 0 as its start?
So the question is, isn't there something else which could have a 0? So, like, in a prefix code, can't we have, like, two things which start with 0? Yes. The lack of ambiguity comes from, like, if we look here, we have, for example, a whole bunch of things that start with 0. But that's fine, because when I'm decoding my document, I just say, okay, I have a 0, now I'm here. I have no ambiguity about what I need to do if I see a 0 or a 1.
Okay.
Like, I have only one decision.
The whole thing's a prefix.
Yeah, so no whole code is a prefix of another. But indeed, the codes do share parts, and it's not the case that we need to always have something of what with, you know, 0 needs to be a symbol. In fact, it won't be. So the question is, if I'm decoding a document, which in fact is our next topic, how do I know? And basically what I'm going to do when I'm decoding a document is that if I have a, you know, something like 0011, I'm going to say, okay, I have 0, so I start here, and I take this 0, makes me go down this path, and now I'm at my... Now I'm here, so there, and that makes me go down this path, And I say, oh, there's no children here. I'm going to output a space. And then I go back to the top. So that is, in fact, our next topic. So when we're decoding, what we're going to do is we're going to first build that tree. So, you know, you might end up representing your prefix code something like this. Real compression things, algorithms tend to have a more compact representation that is, where that actually doesn't write out most of these bits, but even that doesn't actually represent it as a tree. So it's common not to represent it as a tree, but that's fine. You can still build the tree. You just say, okay, I want to build a tree for this, so I'm going to say I have a space I need to add, and there's going to be a node in the zero direction and a node in the zero direction. So I make two nodes. I have 0, 1, 0, 0 I need to add. So there's going to be a U, which comes from there's going to be a U, which comes from a 0, which comes from a 0, which comes from a 0, which comes from a 1, which comes from a 0. Like, so I can build that. I'm actually going to build it starting from this direction, so U 0, 1, 0, 0. So I can build this by reading this representation. So I'm going to do that to build my prefix code tree. Then I'm going to read bits and just go down the tree. I start at the top. Each time I read a bit, I advance down either the left or right child. If I find at any point I'm at a leaf, I say, okay, I'm going to output something and go back to the top, to the root of the tree. So, for example, we're decoding this. Now I have 1, 1, so I'll take 0 and 2. Obviously, that's not meant to be there. Let's do that. But we have 1, 1, and we find a D. And next we go back up to the top. We see we have R as our next character. We have a 1. Whoa, that was not the right thing. Why am I not in? Oh, caps lock, that'll do things. So we have a 1, 1, and right. So we have 1, then we go to 0, and 0, and we find a B, and we keep doing that. We have a 0, we find an A immediately, we output that. And that's just applying the algorithm we see here. So we're just saying, we start at the root, we look at the next bit. If it's a 0, we go down the left. If it's a 1, we go down the right. And then we keep going until we end up at a leaf. So that's how we're going to apply this prefix code tree. So, questions about this, and I apologize for the typo on this slide that I should probably not be trying to correct so much. Obviously, it shouldn't be there. So, questions? Makes sense? So, and this is how we decode, despite the fact that here I've written things out with spaces between each of our symbols. In a real document, you wouldn't do that. because that kind of defeats the point of having this as be a string of bits. Okay, so so we're going to have a lab on Kafka encoding, and there's going to be three parts, as usual. So the pre-lab is going to be the compression part. So you're going to write a program to calculate the letter frequencies of an input. So this means you need to actually do file I/O, which I understand is one of the things people actually have more trouble with in this lab. So we have some like some guides for doing that, but like that's something you need to do. And then use a binary heap. We require you to use a binary heap, but we do have an implementation of a binary heap over integers that we provide that you can use. Obviously, to build a Hoffman tree, as we learned, the binary heap is not a heap over integers, it's a heap over trees. But it should be fairly straightforward to modify one into the other. And then you output the encoding mapping, followed by the encoded message in the format specified in the lab, and the format is what I showed you last time, like this. And then for the encoded message, it's gonna be just bits like this, just to make debugging easy. So the heap code is supplied on the slides. It's linked from the slide page. There's just a CPP and H file, which is binary heaps over integers. So you can modify that. And we have file I/O provided in many sources, which is something that you can use to like actually read the files. You'll need to actually do that. And your program is going to work over printable ASCII characters. So ASCII, as you know, hopefully, I think you've covered ASCII in a prior course, yes? Yeah. So, you know, 7-bit characters, so we have 128 of them. Some of them aren't printable. For the lab, we're only worrying about printable characters. So you don't need to deal with what we call non-printable characters. And what we're calling printable characters are all the characters that have a visible symbol that are ASCII characters. So that's 0x212 0x7e plus the special case of a space character. We are calling the space character printable even though it has no symbol. But we are not, for example, encoding new lines and other white space characters. So, and the heap code is linked off the slides page. And you can modify it. It's the methods what I've shown before. I have shown like sometimes a slightly different version of the method just to make the slide cleaner, but like it's the same thing. It has a constructor, one which takes a vector of ints to turn into a heap. So it takes something that isn't a heap yet and makes it at a heap by inserting each thing, essentially. And it has your usual insert, find, delete, size, make empty, and so on. And it's implemented, as we've seen before, with a vector representing the values and the size, and these percolate up and down methods to do the swapping we talked about. And we've seen the source code for those methods. So the one thing we haven't shown you is the method that constructs one from an unsorted vector. So that is equivalent to repeated insertion. And the way it works is we adjust the vector you supply to have the first element not be used, because remember we follow this convention just to make the indexing easier, that we would choose that the root was at index 1 and not index 0, and this meant we could do times 2 and times 2 plus 1 to get the left and right child. If we didn't do that, we need to do minus 1 the quantity times 2 and so on, which would be fine, but would make our code a little more complicated. And after that, we use the swap down, and that actually ends up constructing a heap. And this is equivalent to repeatedly inserting a value. Okay, there's also a print method there, which does some weird things. Like, it has this funny line of code to determine if something is a power of 2. But the idea of checking if something is a power of 2 is that this will output the heap in a way where you can see each row. And given that, this would be useful for debugging if you want to know what's in there without, like, actually delete min over and over again and then make a new heap. So, questions on anything about heaps or Huffman codes? Okay, so our next topic will be about graphs. So graphs are going to be a generalization of trees. This is one way you can do them. So a graph. This is a graph, and I'm labeling two pieces of this graph. We have vertices or nodes. The terms are interchangeable. I will try to use vertices, but nodes mean the same thing, and we might use that. And we have edges. So our vertices are, in a typical picture of a graph like this, represented by these circles. And our edges are the lines between the circles. That each one connects two vertices to each other. Note that on this drawing, as in many drawings of graphs, I have vertices that cross each other, edges that cross each other, because I can't draw it without doing that. And maybe if I was being really clever, I would indicate that, like, with like break lines or something, that they're not the same edge. But in this center star, there are edges between pairs that cross each other, but they aren't like one big unified edge. Each of them is between one pair of vertices. So those are our components. And we're going to have two types of graphs, which we're going to switch between depending on what we're using graphs for. So we have one type of graph, which we'll call an undirected graph. And in this graph, all the edges are just between two points, and that's all we know about them. They're between two vertices. That's all we know about the edge. In a directed graph, not only is the edge between two vertices, but it also is the case that the edge has a direction, that one of the vertices is what we'll call the source of the edge, and one is the what we might sometimes call the sink or the destination of the edge. And the second type is called the directed graph, or sometimes we'll use the term digraph as a shortening of directed graph. So there are lots of things that naturally get represented as graphs. And we're going to exclude things which are represented as trees. If you notice carefully, a tree fits in this category. Like a tree, you can have vertices, which are its nodes. It has edges, which, you know, it's left and right children, and the up to the parent, those are edges. So trees are graphs. But graphs are less restricted. So this graph up here, certainly not a tree. You know, even if we say that this thing at the top is the root, we have weird things happening here, like what is this node's relationship to the root? There's lots of paths there, so we can't really say that it's a tree. But a tree is a graph, just not the other way around. So we're going to talk about things which are represented as graphs where a tree isn't good enough, where we actually want the extra things we have in a graph. So one example is, say, maps. So So we have a map, like a road map. We might say the nodes are the intersection and our edges are roads. And this representation means that if we look at ways of going between nodes, this gives us like a path to take on roads, which has some real world application. Another example might be airline routes. If you want to figure out what train tickets should you buy, we have a graph that connects the cities, and we want to figure out how do you get from city A to city B on flights, we use this graph representation. And here we have, again, this is not a tree because certainly it's just because I can go from A to B and from A to C doesn't mean I can't go from B to C directly. We can represent, say, flowcharts are another example of something which is a graph. They have loops that we can't have in trees. Similarly, prerequisite trees, so-called trees, this isn't really a tree. Charts, you know, this looks kind of like a tree, but it's not, because even though everything goes in one direction, like a tree does, we have like multiple things going to here, or to here, for example. So like that is not something that we're supposed to have in a tree. So this isn't a tree, this is a more general graph. We need something more general than that. So I gave you sort of an informal definition of a graph with pictures. You know, we have a picture here, but unfortunately, a picture like this is not really what you want to do if we're going to write proofs about what graphs are. So we're going to have a mathematical definition of a graph. And we're going to say that a graph, say, which we're going to say G, if G we say is a thing we're calling a graph, we're going to say that G is a pair of things. One of those things is the set of vertices. And the other of those things is a set of edges. So the vertices can be whatever type of thing makes sense for what we're working with, depending on what the graph represents. And the edges are pairs of vertices. And the difference between a directed and an undirected graph is what types of pairs those are. If we have a directed graph, then those are ordered pairs. The order matters. If we have an undirected graph, those are unordered pairs, so it doesn't matter the order we write them in, they're the same thing. And which type we'll use, again, will depend on context. And these are all both sets, so the order is not going to matter. Like, we can write down the vertices and the edges in any order, and as far as mathematical definitions are concerned, like just because I drew this graph this way doesn't mean that if I drew it in another way such that I have the same vertices and edges, like it's not the same graph. It doesn't matter how I draw it, it's still going to be the same graph because all we care about is what are the vertices, what are the edges. If it has the same edges and vertices, it's the same graph no matter how you draw it. So we're going to want to talk about ways of getting from nodes to nodes in graphs, vertex to vertex. So we have some definitions for that. So first, we're going to have this term adjacent. So we're going to say that two vertices are adjacent if there is an edge connecting them. And to make this work for both directed and undirected graphs, we'll say that it doesn't matter the direction the edge takes. For an undirected graph, obviously, there's an edge where there isn't. For a directed graph, we could have an edge in one direction or both directions. And it doesn't matter, whichever we have, it's adjacent. We also have a path. A path is a sequence of vertices such that each pair in the sequence has an edge between them in the correct direction. So if we have a directed graph, the edges have to be ones we can follow the arrows to get from V1 to Vn by going to V2, then V3, then V4, and so on. In each case, we will have an edge. The length of a path we will define as the number of edges on the path. This is an arbitrary choice. We could have obviously defined it as the number of nodes. And note as a nit here that path is defined if I have one vertex. A path of one vertex is a path. It just has no edges on it. It has length zero. But it's a path. We can, you know, it meets the definition. Sometimes we will talk about simple paths. So a simple path is a path with distinct vertices where we never repeat a vertex. So a path includes paths where we go like A to B to C, back to A to D. That's a path, even though it visits A twice. And a simple path can't do that. It has to go to different vertices every time. We don't repeat vertices. So these are sort of basic definitions and for graphs so far. And this kind of graphs and these kind of paths aren't quite enough to represent some problems we care about. So we're going to have some extra attributes of paths and graphs for things we, you know, actually want to represent. And the biggest thing we're going to use is weights. So we're going to have weights, sometimes called costs, because it turns out just knowing that we have a list of edges isn't good enough to represent some real-world problems. We want to have information about the edges. And in this class, that's what weights are going to be. So we're going to assign a weight or a cost to each edge. And if we have a path, the weight or cost of the path is the weight of all the edges in the path, summed together. And here again, we're making an arbitrary choice. We could have assigned the weights to the vertices. We're not doing that. We're assigning them to the edges. So an example of where that might be useful is if you have a roadmap, say your weights might be distances. And intuitively, finding the least weight path means that you're finding the shortest path. And that would be a common example of what we do. Okay. So related to paths, another type of thing I'll deal with are cycles. So a cycle is a path where it starts and ends in the same place. So on an undirected graph, this graph here has three cycles. Has this cycle that goes around there, this cycle that goes there, and the cycle that includes both of them where we go, say, here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, where we visit one of those vertices in the middle in addition to at both ends. In an undirected graph, we require cycles to have no repeated edges. In a directed graph, our definition does not have that restriction. As I will talk about a little later, you will see slightly different definitions depending on what book or source you're reading for path and cycle. So there's slight disagreement on what it is. A path is always getting from one vertex to another, but there's different restrictions depending on who you're reading. So in a directed graph, like we have, there's lots of options for cycles. These are all examples of cycles, and I probably haven't enumerated all the cycles in this graph. So sometimes we want to talk about a special kind of edge, which is a loop. So a loop is a single edge that goes from a vertex to itself, which if I draw it, probably will look like what you see there. So, as I said, this terminology is not universal. So if you read other sources, they might use slightly different words. And I just like to tell you what they are so you have some idea of what that means. So you might see a the term walk to mean path. And people who do that usually are using the term path for something else, and that something else is usually a simple path. Those people want paths to not be repeated. You mean a simple path. You might train the term closed walk instead of cycle, and people who are doing that typically want the word cycle to mean a cycle that is also a simple path, a cycle with no repeated vertices, besides the beginning and end. Can't draw slides. Okay, we'll draw some pictures instead. So a connected graph is a graph such that there's a path from every single pair of nodes. So this here is a connected graph. This here is an unconnected graph. We generally won't use the word connected graph for digraphs, which is why this definition doesn't make too much sense with digraphs. We'll talk about some terms for digraphs next. So for an undirected graph, connected just means you can get from everywhere to everywhere. So another example is that if we have like this is connected even though we have only one way to get to most places. But if we, even if we have things, as long as we have one vertex that's not hooked up properly, even if it's connected to something, like that's not connected because it has two parts that don't have any edges between them. So connected, unconnected. Okay. So in a directed graph, as I said, we use different terms. So we'll sometimes use the term DAG, and that stands for directed acyclic graph. And that's kind of related to connectivity, but not. So it's related to the next definition of connectivity. So a directed acyclic graph has no cycles. And having no cycles means that, well, we definitely can't have a path from every node to every other node, except if there's only one thing in the graph. And that's because if you think of the case with two nodes, that's a directed acyclic graph. If I decide to add this green edge here, well, that's a problem. That's not directed acyclic anymore. And that means that I can only get from x to y and not vice versa. If it's directed at, I can only go one way and not the other, both. So in a directed acyclic, in a graph, directed graph of any kind, you'll have two definitions of connected. We'll have strongly connected, which means that we have a path from every vertex to every other vertex. And if we choose any pair of vertices, we can get between them. So if I have the green and the blue red edge here, then this is strongly connected. I probably should draw this in size. So I have both of these edges that's strongly connected because I can get from x to y and from y to x. If I only have one of them, it's weakly connected. So weakly connected is, let's pretend it's an undirected graph, so just treat the edges as having no direction. Is it connected as an undirected graph? And no matter, even if I only have one of those edges, that XY graph there is weakly connected. Okay, so let's give some examples of this. So here I have a strongly connected graph, which I've drawn in two different ways. You may notice that it is really hard to tell at sight if two graphs are the same. It's also really hard to tell by computer. That is strongly connected because we can choose any two vertices and we can find a way to get between them. So like if we take A and G, it might kind of look like maybe there's not a way to get between them in both directions, but we can go A, B, E, F, G to get from A to G, and to get from G to A, we can go G, C, D, B, E, F, A. And if you do this for every pair of vertices, you will find that it is actually strongly connected. And the same thing is true here. We have some more obvious cycles that you follow to do it. Even though you have to take a long path that's strongly connected, you can still get from any vertex to any other. And here we have a weakly connected graph. And generally, when you have a weakly connected graph, you can divide it up into parts, which we'll call strongly connected components. So if I take these two pieces here, they internally are strongly connected, but the graph as a whole is weakly connected because I can only go one direction between those components. So we can always divide up a graph that way, just might sometimes turn out that our strongly connected component is one vertex. So questions about connectivity? Okay, so I mentioned that trees are special cases of graphs. And we've seen definitions we need to define trees in terms of graphs. So a tree is a connected graph without cycles. So it's not obvious that that is enough to make it a tree, but it turns out that our usual definition of tree and a connected graph without cycles is our equivalent, assuming we just choose a root. We can choose any node as the root, and then that the two definitions end up matching up. Okay, so I'm gonna have one other special graph term, which is a complete graph. So a complete graph is a graph where we have edges between every pair of distinct vertices. Usually, we can define this for both a directed or undirected graph, just a matter of whether we have all the undirected edges or all the directed edges. So this is a complete graph with all the edges overlapping. You can't really draw it without all the edges overlapping, so I did that, overlapping. And as you can see, they have a lot of edges. In fact, they have order n squared edges if you have n vertices. Okay, so we have our definitions for graphs. And we have this formal representation as a set of vertices and a set of edges. That's not how we're actually going to represent graphs in a computer. We're not going to search a list of edges each time we need to find something, typically. So there's two major representations we might use for graphs. So one of them is something we'll call an adjacency matrix. And here, we're just going to number the vertices. So we're going to choose some numbering, and we're going to have a matrix where we have an entry, if there's an edge, and we'll in fact store any information we need for the edge there. So the only information we've learned that we associated with edges is weights. So we'll store weight. If we have an unweighted graph, we'll say store 0 or 1. 1 if it's an edge there. And we'll store something if there's not anything there. So with weights, we'll say, typically say, we don't have any edges of weight 0, so we'll store 0 to represent that. If we wanted to have edges of weight 0, we need to choose something else to put there, like negative 1 or something. So, for example, I have an edge from 2 to 3, and I'm going to represent that with this 1 in this matrix. And I have an edge from 1 to 4, and from 4 to 1, and I'm going to represent that with 1s in both of the corresponding entries. So this is naturally represents a directed graph, so the edges have a direction. We could also use this to represent an undirected graph. We just like have multiple copies of something, or we just wouldn't use half the matrix. We just decide, if I'm representing an undirected graph, I'm going to have the edges in are always going to be 1, 2, and never 2, 1, and 1, 3, and so on, and just not use half the matrix. But generally, I'm going to show you the representation for a directed graph because that's the more general case. And for an undirected graph, we either duplicate the edges or we decide arbitrarily that of which half of the edges we don't store. So we can also use this to store a graph with weights. So I have weights here. This is typically how I'm going to show weights when I'm drawing a graph, as little numbers next to the edges. And we can store all those weights in our matrix. So this is one way we have to represent graphs. And note that we're only just basically we're representing the set of edges explicitly. This is way of representing the set of edges. And the vertices are kind of implicit just by how many we have, how many entries we have in our matrix. So questions about this representation? So if you're writing this in C++ code, you might use like a two-dimensional array or a vector of vectors or something like that. So another representation that we might use for graphs is an adjacency list. So for an adjacency list, we have a linked list, typically, or some other type of list for every vertex. So, for example, I have an edge from 1 to 2, so I go to the entry, the list for 1, and I find that there's a node labeled 2 on that list. And that tells me there's an edge from 1 to 2. And if I was storing weights, I'd have some other field of this list node that tell me what the weight of the edge was. Any other information I might want to keep around. So those are the two major representations that we will use for graphs. And they have advantages and disadvantages. So let's talk about the issue. So size, which of these is going to take up more space? Anyone want to tell me? Adjacency matrix or adjacency list? Adjacency list. So why? So adjacency matrix depends on number of vertices. And you observe that the adjacency list depends on the number of edges and vertices. So an adjacency matrix is generally, it's sort of n squared elements, always. An adjacency list, we have, we have v plus e, basically, where we have v vertices and e edges. We have v plus e things to store. So I guess I should, instead of n squared, to be consistent, I should say v squared. We have v squared. We have v vertices, we have v squared entries. But v squared entries, but small entries, but list nodes. So in an adjacency list, we have only entries for each edge we actually have, rather than, which is typically smaller than the number of vertices squared, because we don't use all the edges. But each of the entries is a list node. It like has a flex pointer. So even though we're only storing the destination and maybe a weight, we have all this extra space it stores. So if our graph is very full, an adjacency matrix takes up less space. If our graph is pretty empty, an adjacency list takes up less space. Where by full, I mean most of the possible edges exist. So like a complete graph, an adjacency matrix is more compact. Just because we don't store all those next pointers. If we have a graph with, in the most extreme case, with no edges, it's just a bunch of vertices, then an adjacency list is clearly much, much more compact. So there's a non-obvious side trade-off. We also have issues of how easy it is to list edges from a node. So if we want to find the edges from the node in an adjacency matrix, iterate through v things. In an adjacency list, iterate through only edges. So in an adjacency list, we find the right list, we only iterate through the actual edges we care about. In an adjacency matrix, we have to go to the whole row. So like here, if I want to find the edges from 2, I need to check here, 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 and here. So that's a lot less efficient. And similarly, we have an issue of, say, determining if a node has an edge. So if we want to determine if a node has an edge going out of it, then an adjacency list is definitely easiest. We just look at the node's list and we see, is that list empty? If it's not, it has an edge going out of it. If we want to determine if a node has an edge coming into it, well, with an adjacency matrix, we go down a column, and that's not too bad. With an adjacency list, we have to scan every single list to see if there's an edge into that node. So like here, if I want to find out, is there an edge into 4? I actually need to scan all these lists because they could all potentially have an edge into 4, node 4. So it's not clear which of these is the best representation, and we will see different of them used in different contexts. I'd also note that these aren't the only representations we can consider. So, like I showed you adjacency lists with linked lists, we might use some other data structure. Like maybe if we have lots of edges going out of each node, we might represent that list as a binary search tree of some sort. So we can easily look up, does an edge to this particular node exist on that list? We could store an adjacency matrix as a hash table, for example, where the keys are pairs of nodes. And if we do that, well, doing that incoming edge lookup actually becomes very hard. But space requirements are a lot better. You can still efficiently look up a particular entry, and we store space, which is like a small multiple of the number of actual edges we have. And I note that when we're storing graphs in practice, we're often going to store additional information we didn't talk about. So like we're talking about graphs sort of in the abstract, and when we talk about things we're doing on graphs, we're still mostly going to leave things very abstract. But in the real world, when you're representing things with graphs, you're going to want to have useful information on about the vertices and edges. Like if you're representing a map with a graph, probably you want the street names. So you're not just going to store a weight with an edge, you're going to store a street name, like a speed limit, and various other information. And that does fit naturally with our representation, and that just means that each of these list elements actually has a whole like bunch of information attached to it. And that is a very common thing to do on when you have actual graphs and real applications, is that it's not just a list of edges and weights and integer weights. Okay. So next time we'll talk about some algorithms we can do on graphs. And good luck on the lab, I guess.